Here we go. Good evening, everyone. We are studying Parsha Lech Lecha, this week's Torah portion, and we are going to talk about the very difficult question of studying Torah, studying the stories of the Torah, and in particular the stories of Bereishit, the stories of the beginning of the Jewish people and the leaders of the Jewish people. And this week we're introduced to the first two founders of the whole movement, Abraham, and Sarah his wife. And they are faced with many decisions, many challenges, and some of the decisions that they make have been hotly debated. So what we're going to look at is a number of stories, a number of episodes, two that are actually from this week's Torah portion, and then we're going to broaden it and talk a little bit about the question of why the Torah includes narratives, narratives which don't necessarily shed good light on the individuals themselves. Or in other words, we can ask the question one way as, can we even propose that these individuals who are supposed to be the founding fathers or founding mothers of Judaism, can we even propose the possibility that they were anything less than angelic, anything less than perfect, anything less than, above human or superhuman? And if they were more than just human, then what's the purpose of teaching us these stories if they're supposed to be there for us to learn from them? So those are some of the broad questions which I want to look at, and we're going to get there by studying some of the stories from this week's Parsha. So the first one on the page is from the beginning of the portion, Lech Lecha, the name of the book, the name of the Parsha, where God commands Abraham to leave his native land, go forth from your native land, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, and from your father's home, right? Me Beit Avicha, Mi Moladercha, Ela Aretz Asher Aka, to the land that I will show you. And God promises Avram great things. He says, I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and curse him that curses you. And all the families of the earth shall be bless themselves by you. You're going to be a source of blessing for all nations. And by the way, the name Avram changes to become Avraham. And the Talmud teaches that the reason why his name gets changed is because his scope of influence expands as his personality develops in these portions that we're going to read in the coming weeks. So in the beginning of the story, he's Avram. He's the father of Aram, which is a limited region. It's a limited group, if you will. Whereas as his family begins to expand and as his area of influence begins to expand, he becomes Avraham, Av Hamon Goyim, the father of many nations. And this is something that God promises him here right at the beginning. All you have to do is leave everything behind, start from scratch, literally start from scratch in a new place, with new surroundings, with new people, and I'll take care of the rest. So Avram goes, verse 4, as the Lord had commanded him, and his relative Lot came with him. Avram was 75 years old. We'll talk more about Lot next week when we delve into the story of Sodom, this very evil city that was destroyed, will be destroyed in the discussion next week. And Lot is a resident of that city, but that only happens partway through this week's Torah portion when Lot and Avram split ways. But more on that next week.
So why did he go?
Why did
Avram go?
Why did he leave?
Yeah. I'm going to tell you. To
presumably, it's a very good question.
And go down to Australia.
It's a great question. There is no explicit indication in the text of, there is a monetary incentive. Okay, there is a you could look at this and say there's a motivator here for Avram to go. God is promising him wealth, or he's promising him
promises. How do you argue with God? Yeah, he says go, you go.
And adding to that, Avram didn't have any children. There was a promise here about children.
Right.
So there are a number of motivating factors, but there's also the thrill of a new journey, the thrill of new opportunities.
But he wasn't doing so bad where he was.
Well, it's not about him not doing so bad. It's about his the sphere of influence, which I mentioned before. The characters that were surrounding him in his hometown weren't the best of folk.
So he had an ego.
I wouldn't say it was that. I would say that he understood a new truth. He understood a new type of thinking, a new way of thinking about God, of thinking about the world, and he wasn't finding the people around him to be the most friendly, to put it lightly, of individuals to be able to talk to them about it.
Was he leaving his aged parents?
He was leaving his whole family. He was leaving everybody. See, he's 75 years old. Okay, it's a big move to make that point in his life, and he takes his wife, verse 5, and his brother's son. So Lot is his nephew. His brother's name was Terach, if you remember from the previous last week. It was a short snippet at the end of Noach on his family. And all the wealth that they had amassed and all the people that they had acquired in Haran. So this could either mean maybe slaves, or some commentaries say these were people that they had successfully converted to their new monotheism or way of thinking and religion. And they arrive in Canaan. When they get there, verse 6, Avram starts to travel different parts of the land till he finds somewhere that he can settle down. So he goes to Shechem. In verse 7, God appears to him again, and he says, I'm going to assign this land to your offspring. If you remember, a few weeks ago we spoke in the book of Bereishit. We were talking about the rights of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. This is one of the explicit references where God promises the land of Israel to Avram and his descendants. So that's verse 7. And he builds an altar there. He thanks God. Then he moves to Beit El. You've heard of Beit El before. A pretty large Jewish community now there in the West Bank. Yehuda and Shomron, others like to call it, and he builds there another altar, and then he goes to the Negev, and that ultimately is going to be the area where he settles down. But just before he's able to get started, there's a famine in the land, verse 10. There's a famine in the land, and Avram goes down to Egypt to save himself and his family from starvation. Now, Rashi, right, it's not here on the page, but the commentary writes, Rashi's commentary, he says that if you look at the language in verse 10, it says there was a famine in the land. And he says that there was only a famine in the land of Canaan, in the land of Israel. That was the only place in the region that actually had a scarcity of food. And because of this, the read of this story is that God was doing this to test Abraham. There wasn't actually, he went to Egypt. Egypt is not that far away. The fact that Egypt had food of plenty, and there that area did not, doesn't necessarily mean that one could and could not have famine in one area or the other, but it does indicate that there was food close by. So the famine that was taking place was specifically in that land, and Rashi says God was testing Avram. Now, what was the test? He doesn't say what the test was. So if I turned it to you and said, how was this meant to be a test? So you can either look at it, I think, in one of two ways. The test was either, is he going to stay? or is he going to leave? But each of them could be viewed as positive, and each of them could be viewed as negative on their own. Staying would mean what? If he were to stay in the land, he would be
listening
to God. God promised him everything's going to be okay, and I'm going to take care of you, and I'll take care of your needs. So it would be a sign of faith, a symbol of belief, of faith, of trust. And if he would leave, you could see that as a negative. The other way to look at it is, of course he has to leave.
If he stays, he dies.
If he stays, maybe we're not supposed to be relying on a miracle, you know, in all instances in life. And in this instance, he has a family, he has people, he has, you know, he has animals, he has things that need to be taken care of. And for him to stay would be viewed as crazy. So for him to leave was practical, pragmatic, whatever word you want to use. He was doing his effort. And maybe God would look at that and say, you know what? You did the right thing by leaving. So the question is, what was the test? Was the test to stay and show his faith? Or was the test to leave and show his partnership in a way?
Of course, when he goes, he doesn't know that he's coming back.
Presumably, a famine is something that people had encountered before and was something that would hopefully come to an end. Hopefully.
He'd hope to come back.
He would hope to come back. He didn't necessarily know if it was going to be in a week from then or in a month or longer, but the hope would be to be able to come back. Now, the answer to the question, what was the test, is it's both. It's a debate in the commentaries, like any good Jewish topic, whether Abraham did the right thing or he did the wrong thing. So the first commentary to take a stab at this was the Ramban, writing in the 13th century. And what he says is not only did he make the wrong decision, but he should be ashamed of himself. It was a great sin. If you look in the language and source too, you should know that our father Avram committed a great sin. Unintentionally. He didn't necessarily realize the consequence of that action. The next part of the story, he gets down to Egypt. His wife is very beautiful. And Pharaoh, the Pharaoh of the time, wants to take his wife. Now, Pharaoh doesn't know that she's his wife. He basically tells his wife not to reveal that information and to play a game that she's a sister, rather than a wife, just in case he tries to kill off Avram and take his wife. He was protecting himself and his wife. Could he have foreseen that possibility of leaving Canaan and coming to Egypt? And that, not necessarily, it was unintentional, but the fact that he made the decision to leave was a sin because it caused
this problem to
come about. And then he writes, if you look down three or four lines to the next italicized line, also his going out from the land of which he had been commanded at the beginning due to famine was a transgression that he committed, because Elohim would have saved him from dying even in a famine. And because of this deed, it was decreed, listen to this, that his seed, meaning the descendants of Avram, the Jewish people, three generations later, so those are the children of Jacob, would end up in Egypt, and their descendants would end up being enslaved, Passover story, in Egypt.
That's a pretty severe consequence to a decision where somebody, you could go either way.
Right. So where does this idea come from? So this notion, I've mentioned it a few times in this context, in this setting here, a large kind of rabbinic idea of reading the book of Bereshit as what we call Ma'aseh Avot Siman Labanim, the happenings of the founding fathers, of the forefathers, are events that are in many ways built into the bedrock of Jewish history, and shine light onto all future events. Maaseh Avot, the happenings of the fathers, are a siman, are a sign for future things to come. That all events of Jewish history are in a way rooted in the events of early Jewish history. It's not necessarily everything that we've ever experienced as a people is rooted back in this book, but the happenings of the fathers of these people are powerful moments which impacted in many ways later events. So the Ramban is a champion of this concept, and he looks at every event that took place to Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob and their wives and their children as events which are foreshadowing. We looked at one of them not last week, but 2 weeks ago, where there's a battle over the wells. We spoke about it, the wells of that Abraham dug the wells. The Philistines, the Plishtim, came along and filled them up. And then Abraham's son Isaac comes along and re-digs the wells. And the Ramban says, what's the point of telling us this whole story? It's to foreshadow the temples of Jerusalem. How does digging a well foreshadow the two temples that were destroyed and the eventual third temple? I don't know. He's talking, you know, in terminology that's esoteric and a little Kabbalistic, but the essence of the idea is these are not random occurrences. These are events which shed light on the future. So the Ramban is going with this idea here as well. He looks at Abraham's action as having a consequence even so severe, maybe not on its own, but a component of it, of the Jewish people being enslaved in that time. And it is a radical statement. There's no getting around the notion of that. And it's something you couldn't
construe that as being an evil deed that he, you know, that it would have that type of consequence.
Right.
So it's kind of
right. The view of the Ramban and what he's really saying here is Abraham was showing a lack of faith, if you had to put it in different words. Okay? And if that's deserving of such a punishment of a future generation, That is a very powerful concept. Okay? Agree or disagree, it's a powerful concept. If you look at source 3, the Radak was also writing in the time of around the same time as the Ramban. He takes a very different look at this story. And he says, you know what? Not only did he not make the wrong decision, but he made the best decision. He made the right decision. We have an ironclad rule in Judaism called Ein Somchin Al Anes. We don't rely on miracles. We believe that we have an obligation to go out and make something of ourselves in the sense of going out to work, or even on the more basic level, house insurance, life insurance, insuring things, and not just leaving life up to, not chance, but up to God and God's miracles. In a way, what we're doing is we're saying, God wants us to be doing this because we don't live in a world where miracles are happening in front of our eyes. So I'm not going to live that type of lifestyle. So Abraham taking his family and leaving to Mitzrayim, leaving to Egypt, was a good decision. Look how he says it. Source 3, as to why he did not trust God, who had promised to make him into a great nation, a promise that he had not yet begun to be filled. And then he says, look in the fourth line, he says, the promises by God are based on man having taken every reasonable precaution not to require a miracle to save him from danger. And then if you just skip down, our sages have told us the last line, it's inadmissible to sit with one's hands waiting for God to perform a miracle to save one's life. One must not leave matters to miracles. So, this is one episode, it's one story. We're going to look at a second story in a moment, of a individual, a great individual, the founding father of Judaism, of monotheism, of the great, you know, faiths, monotheistic faiths, and so many religious people in our world today trace their roots back to this individual. And here the Torah is sharing a story which, at least according to some readings of it, is not such a positive reflection on the individual. And the question is why? Why would the Torah share such an event? So I know the writing is a little bit small here on source number 4. It's a photocopy from the book itself. Samson Raphael Hirsch, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who is a great, incredible commentary and exegete, and he wrote on the Jewish prayers, and he wrote on Psalms, and he wrote on really prolific. And his writing is, he actually wrote originally in German. The original commentary was written in German, and then it was translated into different languages. It was translated into Hebrew, it was translated into English. And he has a comment here, which he makes in a number of places, but here is where he really gets to the crux of his position on this idea. And he's answering the question that was just raised. Why would the Torah share episodes or events of people's lives, of great people's lives, of failure, of error, of mistake? And what he essentially says, and I'll just read one or two points in here, they're a little bit highlighted, the ones that I wanted to focus on, are that these events help us, number one, understand why these stories are being shared in the first place, and number two, they allow us to see these individuals, on the one hand, both as human beings that made mistakes, but at the same time, great human beings who we can also learn from and draw wisdom and draw experience into our own lives from them. So what he says is the Torah, I'm here just in the middle of the paragraph in source 4, the Torah never presents our great men as being perfect. And this is, maybe he's writing to a certain type of audience, he says it deifies no man, right? The Bible, the Torah, doesn't turn man into God, into a God. And says of none, here you have the ideal, in this man the divine became human. Altogether, it puts the life of no man before us as the pattern out of which we are to learn what is right and good, what we have to do, and what refrain from doing. And then he says, where the word of God would set a pattern before us for us to imitate, it places no man born of dust. There God says, look at me, imitate me, wander in my ways. We are never to say, this must be right, for did not so and so do it. Right? The Torah is no collection of examples of saints. It relates what occurred, not because it was exemplary, but because it did occur. And we're not afraid to hide these incidents. The Torah never hides from us the faults, errors, and weaknesses of our great men. Just by that, and this is the last point here on this one, just by that, it gives us the stamp of veracity to what it relates. And then if you, the next line he says, but in truth, by the knowledge which is given us of their faults and weaknesses, our great men are nowise made lesser, but actually greater and more instructive. If they stood before us as the purest models of perfection, we should attribute them as having a different nature. And then there's nothing to learn from them. If they're angels, if they're superhuman, if they're gods, then they're not there for us to draw inspiration and wisdom and life experience. Were they without passion, without internal struggles, their virtues would seem to us the outcome of some higher nature, hardly a merit and certainly no model that we could hope to emulate. So on and so forth. You get the idea. What Rav Hirsch is doing here is he's building this philosophy of how we study the stories of our founding fathers and our founding mothers. And it's so fascinating that what he does is he not only allows us to read these stories with what you might call a human view, that they were humans just like us. They were people just like us in a way. It also allows us to say that because it tells us about their downfalls and their failures, because it relates these events, it actually makes them greater. It turns them into greater life lesson givers than had the stories not been shared at all. Let's look at a second episode, also from this week's Torah Parsha. This story is what you would call even a little bit more explicit. There really isn't that much debate around the negative commentary on the parties involved. And in this case, it wasn't Abraham, it was his wife. And the story goes, as you see here in Source 5, Bereishit chapter 16, Sarai, whose name also is changed, will be changed, to Sarah, Abraham's wife. She had no children. And she's getting older. And she did have an Egyptian handmaid named Hagar. And Sarai says to her husband Avram, she says, "Behold, right, God has not allowed me to give birth. Please come to my handmaid, sleep with my handmaid, and bear a child through my handmaid." And this was the process through which she would, you could call it, vicariously have a child. She is going to kind of have a child through Hagar. And Avram listened. His wife speaks. He listens. He goes ahead. She brings Hagar. And Avram is together with Hagar. And she conceives. And she's pregnant. And what happens is there's a tension that is developed in the house.
But before that, you think they were intending to adopt the child as their own?
To adopt the child as their own?
I mean, before the jealousy, before sending away.
I would say that there was nothing wrong, you know, in the time of the Torah to have more than one wife.
Right.
So that was probably in the talks, right, at the time. So Sarai says to Avram, verse 5, "May my injustice be upon you. I gave my handmaid into you, and she saw that she had become pregnant. I became unimportant in her eyes. May the Lord judge between me and you." And Avram says to Sarai, "Here is your handmaid in your hand. Do to her that which is proper in your eyes."
What does he mean? Does he mean by "my injustice be upon you"?
Well, I think she expected things to go differently. She probably thought that he would conceive this child and then Hagar would be out of the picture.
Go back to his
wife. Right? And she would just be a handmaid again. And she, you know, but that's not what happened. Her status was raised up through this experience. And now they're competing wives. They're competing for time. They're competing for attention. And Avram says to Sarai, "Okay, you know, you're the love of my life. You're my wife, and I'm going to let you do what you would like with Hagar." And it's very explicit. It's not that the Torah doesn't hide its words in this story. The language in Hebrew is "vate'ana." She afflicts her. Sarai afflicts Hagar, and Hagar basically runs away. She leaves the house. She can't handle the experience of what Sarai was doing to her. And if you look in Source 6 and Source 7, commentaries don't spare their words. They're quite critical of her actions. But Te'ana Sarai, Radak talks about overburdening her with work, making her perform work in an intolerably harsh manner. It's even possible the word "vatana" includes physical as well as verbal abuse of Hagar by Sarai. And that's a stain, in a way, on this founding mother of the Jewish people. The Torah testifies that Sarai did not act piously toward her. Although Avram had given her a free hand when he said, "Do to her as appears fit in your eyes," from a moral point of view, she should have treated Hagar in a manner befitting her status as a wife or legal companion of Avram. And the Ramban again, the same Ramban who was quick to criticize Avram for leaving Canaan to go to Egypt, here he also uses this, invokes his futuristic shedding light and foreshadowing of things to come. And this one's a little bit more, right in our news every single day. Sarai oppressed her, she fled from her presence. And he writes, source 7, our mother sinned in this oppression, and also Abraham in permitting her to do so. And Hashem heard Hagar's oppression and gave her a son who would be a wild ass of a man to press the descendants of Abraham and Sarah in all kinds of oppression. So that son, Yishmael, wasn't just a one-time deal. It was that action of Sarai at that moment impacted all of Jewish history to this day. That the descendants of Yishmael, whoever those descendants are, okay, without going into detail and biological testing, whoever those descendants are, the oppression of the Jewish people in subsequent generations was the spiraling of history that started with this action. So you see a little bit of a theme in this commentary, not just laying criticism, but seeing those actions as being impactful upon the future. And sharing these stories are troublesome, because we look at these people as the founding mothers and fathers of the Jewish people.
Abraham and Sarah didn't know that they were going to have an impact on the future by these acts. I mean, when God gave Abraham the covenant and told him his people were going to be in exile in Egypt, he didn't say it was because he had gone down earlier.
That's a great point. A lot of commentaries talk about this idea that the first humans to walk the earth, take the story of Cain and Abel from Genesis, from Bereshit, the first act of murder in history. They didn't even know what that was. The concept didn't exist before that.
There were no criminal lawyers?
probably were.
You kill an animal, you kill a person.
What was that?
You kill an animal, you kill a person.
Killing a human being is different than killing an animal.
They may not distinguish anything.
The idea being that the actions of Abraham hadn't, how could he know? How could he know? He couldn't, and you're right. And that makes the question stronger in a way. It heightens the question, because it makes us look at this and say, all the more so we shouldn't lay down the criticism. They're making important decisions to save their family, to balance the equation in the home, however you want to call it. So we can go back, we can take Rav Hirsch, we can take that idea, and we can look at that and say, well, these are here to remind us that these were real people with real struggles, but there's a different way to look at it, a very different way. And that's one of the examples of it is here in source number 8. We know that Hagar ended up back in the house. Yishmael is born, and Yishmael, and then Yitzchak is born. Isaac is born next week's Torah portion. And Isaac and Yishmael are being raised in the same home. And Sarah doesn't like it. She doesn't want her son Isaac hanging out with Ishmael. She sees his personality, she sees his character, she sees his... and remember, Ishmael is not her child. Ishmael is the child of Hagar. But Hagar is a wife, or at least a concubine, whatever the status of that relationship was, of Abraham, and he's a child. So for her to create the situation where he gets sent out of the house, which happens, that's something that also reflects in a certain way on her. Positive or negative, you can, again, look at it from different angles. So this commentary in Source 8 is from Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Rabbi Aaron Cutler was the founder of the Lakewood, New Jersey yeshiva community. Today, it's the largest yeshiva in the world. I think it has something like 6,000 students studying Torah. every day. And he came from Europe, and he established this community. It's the fastest growing city in New Jersey. That I just heard recently, which doesn't surprise me, but it's just an interesting side point. So here's what he writes. He takes the approach, and he actually has an article, an editorial. I didn't have space to put it in here, where he looks at a newspaper that was being written in the 1920s. It was a Hebrew newspaper. What they were doing in this newspaper is they were criticizing the actions of the forefathers, the founding fathers, founding mothers. And he felt that this was inappropriate. He felt that this was, not just inappropriate, but false. You're spreading lies. And he's taking the approach that if we ever want to lay criticism on these people, we're wrong. I want to read through it. It's in Hebrew. I'm going to translate it. And it's a very fascinating, different angle on this whole concept and issue. So he says, "Kashinigashim le'inyan Yishmael v'Yitzchak." When we get to the conversation about Yishmael and Yitzchak, "Bahasagot v'ashkafot shel anashim regilim." Ubifrat bedor zeh, so if we're looking at it as regular people living in this generation, okay, the last 100 years, efshar lit'ot, we can make a mistake. Shaitakan tigra ben shtei nashim aschuyot b'neim. You might just say, you know what it was? It was a fight between two women over the future of their children. And he said that conclusion would be a very simplistic a read of the story. Asur lahalot zor aladat hamachshava zo ikfira mamash. He says this is heresy. To suggest such a conclusion would be heretical. It would be kfira. Zegamu mikabel aseichal ki rekodesh baruch hu tzivah la'avram lishma v'kosara. First of all, God commanded Abraham to listen to everything his wife said. Uvistam tigra ben shtei nashim lo yakodesh baruch hu mitzaveh zot. And if it was just a little fight between two mothers, God would never have said, Abraham, whatever your wife says, you listen. And then he broadens it and he says, in general, the actions of the fathers, of the forefathers, they were building the foundational blocks of the future of the Jewish people. Therefore, and this is an approach. It's a way of thinking, of looking at these stories. There couldn't be any negative outside influence that would impact the future of the Jewish people. So having Yishmael leave the house is not just about the education of my son is not going to be, so wonderful if he has to be in the presence of the other brother. It's much more than that. This is the founding of the Jewish people. And we have to do that in the most careful and sensitive and thought out process. And then he writes about halfway down, this is it. We had just had one chance in history to make it work. Avram, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And if we had any problematic external influence changing that paradigm, changing that structure, even in a small, minute way, he says, that would impact the Jewish people forever. Matan Torah, Geula, Yom Adin, the receiving of the Torah, the redemption, all of these events in history, right? We're all in potential at that moment. And he goes on, but he's basically building this idea that we have to be very, very careful when we read these stories to not just say, you know what, Sarai, she was harassing Hagar, she was abusing her, and she's God forbid, a terrible person. Or Abraham, he lacked faith, and what kind of a Jew is this, and he's rejecting God. He says, not so quickly. Let's not pass judgment before we analyze this really in depth. Let's look at another one or two episodes that we know about here in source number 9. One of the more famous ones. Isaac is getting very old. It's coming up in a number of weeks in the Parsha. And he decides it's time to bless his children. He has two children, Jacob and Esav. Yaakov and Esav. Now Esav, in many ways, is the favored child. Jacob loves Esav. He confides in him. He spends a lot of time with him. And he also loves Jacob, but in a different way. And Esav is the eldest. They're twins, but Esav came out first. And since he's the eldest, he is given rights to what we call the firstborn, the bechor, the firstborn blessing. The birthright. And that birthright is a tremendous, powerful blessing. Now, the mother in the story here is Rivka, Rebecca. She sees what's happening. She sees what's about to go down is that Isaac is going to give this blessing and he's going to put it into the wrong hands, according to her opinion, the wrong hands. So she comes up with this whole plan where Jacob is going to dress up, right, in the clothing of his brother, and he's going to basically fool his blind father. He's pretty much blind at this point. He's going to fool him into thinking that he is Esav. Remember the story? He shows up, and, right, he feels the skin, and then, source 9. This is Bereishit chapter 27. Vayomer Yaakov el Aviv. Yaakov says to his father, Anochi Esav Bechorecha. I am Esav, your firstborn. Asiti kasher dibarta Eli. I did exactly what you asked me to do, which was to cook some food and to prepare dinner, basically. So sit up, I'm going to feed you, and then you'll give me your blessing. Now, Rashi in the commentary says, everybody thinks that Jacob lied to his father. What did he say? He said, Anochi, I am Esav, your firstborn. Sounds like a lie, right? Yeah. He's not Esav, he's Jacob. How could he say that to his father? How could the founding father, the third founding father of Judaism, lie? And how could the Torah write about such an event? So you know what Rashi says? He says, no. You just have to put a comma into the phrase. Anochi.
I am.
Who am I? I'm bringing you food. Esav Bechorecha. Esav happens to also be your firstborn. Wow, that's fancy footwork. Right?
Must be a lawyer.
Fancy footwork. Hold on a second. You read this story. This does not... It's very hard to twist this, to make it sound like Jacob was not really lying. He was being very careful about his language and
like Hillary Clinton.
You can be careful, right? So he said. So the Midrash in the bottom of the page takes this to an even further extent and actually justifies what he did and says. No, he says that he was Esav. Vadaya marshahu Esav. Umiboro lamad l'shanot mipnei darkei shom. You know where Jacob learned how to change his language? He learned from God. Where does God do this? For purposes of peace. Kemosha matzinu b'sara. What happened was Sarah, right, is told... by the angels that she's going to have children. Okay? She's promised that she's going to have children. And she basically laughs. She thinks it's ridiculous. I'm too old. I'm gonna have children. She thinks it's a joke. So what does God say? So he says, Lama zet sachaka sara lemor ha'af umnam ele v'ani zakanti. Right? Why is she laughing? And saying, I'm going to really have children, I'm so old, right? So, this is a form of some kind of twisting of language for peace. Jacob was doing what he needed to do. It was for pure intention to get that blessing and to feed his father. Now, we know this story is a difficult story to read and to try to justify, call it lying, call it a white lie, call it what you want to call it. It's a difficult story to read, and it's a difficult story to wrap your head around, and it's just one of many. It's one of many others. So let's...
The end justify the means?
That's a little bit, not, it's a particular ends, yeah. Right? It's a particular ends, but that is what it seems to be implying. Although it doesn't whitewash, it doesn't say that he didn't lie, it says that he did lie, but the lie was permitted. There are situations where lying is permitted.
He's not perfect.
Well, I'd like to know what they are.
You like to know what they are. So trying to bring this down a little bit to our thinking, just the last page, some very, very interesting notes on this. First is a comment in Source 10 from Rav Shlomo Aviner, who's a yeshiva, head of a yeshiva in...
Is it just my copy that's in Hebrew?
They're all in Hebrew, I'm going to translate what that one as well. And what he does here, similar to Rabbi Cutler, similar to Aaron Cutler, I mean, different than Rav Hirsch, who took a more... open type of approach, he says that these people, these individuals, are not like us. They're not like us at all. And really we have to be very careful about how we pull wisdom from their lives. Kodem Kol, he writes in the middle of the first line, Heim inkei ruach gedol le'olam. They're the greats. They're the founding fathers, as we called them a few times here. Ha'avot heim heim ha'merkava. They represent the chariot of God, okay, in one passage. The divine rests among them. Ha'shchina sharebehem, second line, in their actions, in their personalities, in their souls, in their spirit, in their limbs, in their beings.
So they have like diplomatic immunity.
Okay, of some sort. Lo b'mikre, third line, Ribono shel olam gazar b'chokhmato. God didn't just randomly pick these people, he says, that these should be the founding personalities of Judaism. Kolomar shenachila historia shlana b'imke olam. Heim imke anke olam v'heyesh lem chesronot. He says, both can be true. They can be great and they can have flaws. And that is the approach that I think for us is the healthy balance between all of these different competing ways of looking at these stories. They can be great ones who also have flaws. Chesronot shel gedolei olam. But they are flaws on their level. If any of us would make those kinds of decisions that they would when faced with the same types of challenges, perhaps the flaw would not be viewed as severe or as large. Kach amru rabotenu, second last line there, v'pnei ma lo nikalu tamei Torah, rei shnei mikrot nikalu tamam, v'nichshol ben gadol ha'olam. Remember Shlomo, King Solomon? The Torah says you're not allowed to have a lot of wives. You're not allowed to have a lot of stuff. You're not allowed to, kings, specifically. In reference to kings. These are laws that kings are supposed to be modest and not frivolous and not greedy. And goes ahead King Shlomo, Solomon, and he has 1,000 wives and he has stables with horses. But that's not what it's written in the Torah, how a king is supposed to behave. He writes, "Heim einam b'nei adam kamonu." So we have to toe the line between viewing these people as great, as founders, and at the same time, with their flaws and with their. And I think this is very powerful. This source in Source 11, passage from a book written by Walter Kaufman, called The Faith of a Heretic. And in here he has a passage where he writes, in India, The Jinnah and the Buddha, founders of two new religions in the 6th century BCE, came to be worshipped later by their followers. In China, Confucius and Lao Tse, came to be deified. To the non-Christians, Jesus seems to represent a parallel case. In Greece, the heroes of the past were held to have been sired by a god, or to have been born of goddesses, and the dividing line between gods and men became fluid. In Egypt, the pharaoh was considered divine. But in Israel, no man was ever worshipped or accorded even semi-divine status. And I brought, to kind of drive this home, one of the last verses in the entire Torah, that when Moses dies, the Torah indicates that the grave site is unknown. The grave site of Moshe, the grave site of Moses, does not have a marker and does not have an exact location.
We don't even know the mountain.
We know the mountain. Har Nevo. We know the mountain. Do we know if that's exactly the mountain that we're looking at today? That's a different question. But the exact spot, and they've looked and they've searched, and people think they know where it is. But the Torah says you're never going to find it, because God did not leave any hint or sign behind of where he's buried. And the question is, why did God make it this way? And based on some of our reading, I don't really need to read the whole source here, we can understand why. Because the Torah is not looking to turn a human being into a god. And if we mark Moses' grave, what would become of that grave? It would become a shrine. It would become a place where people would go to worship the person, the individual, and turn that individual, that human, into something that's something that's not human. And he's just,
in Hebron you have
Ma'arat HaMachpelah, but people go there to pray, not seeing those people as gods, but seeing those people as those individuals as inspiration for connection with God, or as some would call it, you know, intermediaries, you know, to pray on behalf of, whatever that means, but not that they themselves act as, they're not going to answer the prayers. They may have the spiritual merit to bring the prayers to God or help the individual. And he says it here. He says in Source 12, he writes about this idea, Ha'ish Moshe, right? Lo yada ish. And makom kavurato, no man knows his resting place. The emphasis on the idea of ish, because he was a man, because he was a physical person. And he goes on, and he goes into this idea. But the concept, I think, is very powerful. And the last source, I know the writing is very small, so I'll just share it outside, and we're gonna wrap up in a moment. It's a very interesting article that was written by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman in a Jewish Action magazine. And what he does there is he talks about, and if any of you have on your shelves somewhere a story about a Hasidic rabbi or a rabbi from a previous generation, maybe a biography of someone. And a lot of these books and these stories are about miracles that they performed and crazy situations that they were in and people that they saved. And it's basically a book which is about a person, but it doesn't sound like it's about a person. It sounds like it's about a superhuman. And nothing in those books ever really talks about, you know, he says here, most of these life stories, if you look in the left column, with a few shining exceptions, have common themes. The individual was brilliant, profound, wise, righteous, and kind. He was never angry, never discouraged, never wasted any time, never had any inner conflicts. Thus it comes as no surprise that certain questions that are crucial to understanding of any major leader, will rarely be addressed. And if you look, the next second column. For example, did Torah study come easily to this particular rabbi, or is he possessed of only an average mind, learning to master the intricacies of the Torah through sheer force of will and diligence? Did he ever have intellectual struggles, crises of faith? Did he ever suffer any personal disappointments or tragedy? Was his path from infancy to world-renowned scholarship and leadership an unimpeded upward trajectory, or were there other paths that beckoned, other byways that tempted him? It just sounds like they go from, you know, born in city X, and all of a sudden they're the head of a yeshiva of 6,000 students. We learn all about the gadol, this great one's dazzling scholarship, but how was he as a father, a husband, a teacher? He obviously was a very angelic person, and so on. And then he drives it home with this line in the third column, which I think is just so powerful and so true about our generation. About our world today. And he writes, there are stories and there are stories. The story of Joseph and his brothers. The longest sustained narrative in the entire Torah, and it's true, it covers multiple Torah portions, is obviously more than a mere story. As part of Torah, it's more than narrative, and its multi-layered structure illuminates and instructs in ways that we cannot fathom. But at the very least, it contains critical lessons for living. This is a story about brothers who hated each other and who were not just ready, but did sell their own brother, throw him in a pit and sell him away. And the Torah tells us that story. And look what he writes. To view it merely as good literature would be to denigrate it. But even on the most elementary level, the narrative with its lights and shadows, positives and negatives, is uplifting precisely because it is multi-hued, uncompromising. And then he says, in the fourth column, one shudders to think how it would be written today. Right? Imagine we were writing this story of Joseph and his brothers today. Would any contemporary religious writer dare mention that Joseph in his youth was concerned with his physical appearance? As for Jacob's favoring one son over another, we mentioned it before, Jacob, Isaac, right? Would not our writer gloss over that inconvenient fact? Would Joseph's tale-bearing be omitted? The tale-bearing on his brothers, it says in the text, as well as the jealousy of his brothers. Would not the story of Judah and Tamar, right? Tamar was his daughter-in-law. Tamar was married to Judah's sons. Judah ends up having a relationship with Tamar. Is that one going to be written? That's a story they don't teach in second grade. But would it have even been written? As with the story of Joseph and the wife of Potiphar. We know that story as well. And the slaughter of the inhabitants of Shechem. Right? Where Dina, who's one of the daughters of Jacob, she's raped in the city of Shechem. And two of Jacob's sons, Levi and Shimon, go and murder the inhabitants of the city. Would that story have been written about? The actual hurling of Joseph into the pit, his subsequent sale into slavery, would not this cast an unflattering and cruel light on the brothers and be expurgated from the story? So you see where he's going with this. The idea is compelling. It's such a strong point. And just to conclude, I think that Bereshit is an exciting book. Because it tells us about the beginning of our people. It teaches us about the founding fathers, the founding mothers, the formative stories of our history. And I guess the message is to tread carefully. On the one hand, to look at these people as amazing accomplishments, fantastic lives that they lived. And on that level where they were, they also had flaws because they were human at the end of the day. But for us to be able to read the stories and on the one hand see that and be inspired by the fact that they weren't perfect, but at the same time also be inspired by all of the amazing decisions that they made, all of the great things that they accomplished, and ultimately the ability for us to be where we are today as a credit to those individuals who started this whole process in these stories of Bereshit. Okay.